Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisha Show, broadcasting live from Birmingham, not from Jerusalem. I know that last week's show was from Jerusalem, but the week before that was from Brooklyn, and now we're in Birmingham. That's right, Birmingham. That's the correct way to pronounce it. If you say Birmingham, they won't really know what you're talking about. And this is a place that's about 2 hours north of London, drive that is, and it is the scene of a very large Jewish convention called Limud, L-I-M-M-U-D, Limud. If you look it up, you'll see it's actually a massive organization, a global organization, which holds these, how else can we call it, but kind of a Jewish conference with many, many intellectual topics being discussed. Really, it's a teaching conference, classes of various sorts. I've been to a class about vodka. There's classes about Brexit. There's classes about Jewish texts. There's classes about a lot of liberal Jewish ideas, some stuff about Israel, a lot of different stuff. For example, I heard another a session today by Peter Lerner, who's the spokesman of the IDF, Lieutenant General, I think. It was really great, fantastic opportunity to meet all kinds of different Jews and to talk Jewish. Remember that old Hillel line, do Jewish with other Jews? That was Hillel, I mean the American campus organization, the college campus organization. That's exactly what Limud really is. And I came up with a tagline for what this conference is about. It's about Jewish curiosity, really, Jewish curiosity. And I was invited to take part in this conference. In fact, I've done 6 sessions, and another one is coming up right after I do this interview with Jonathan Newman, who writes on politics and religion for publications in the UK, US, and Israel, and lectures to youth, students, and adults. He's an anti-BDS activist, and he blogs at Commentary, one of the top Jewish intellectual newspapers out there in the English language. And Johnny's also in charge of bringing other voices to Limud, sometimes from the more nationalistic, some would call it the right or the conservative side of the equation. Johnny, thank you so much for joining me on the show today, and thank you so much for helping me come out to Limud.
It's great to be here, Yishai. It's great to have you here.
It has been really fun for me, although a lot of people were warning me that if I come out to Limud, I'm going to face a lot of very liberal Jewish audiences, and that has proven to be true.
Right. Well, look, I don't think you're no stranger to that. You have plenty of tours coming through Hebron and elsewhere that you speak to, so you're totally used to all of that. But yeah, this is a pretty liberal place. There are a number of reasons for that.
What are the reasons for that?
So I think one of the main things in this
because it's not only that this conference is liberal. One could say that British Jewry outside of ultra Orthodox Jewry is liberal, quite to the left on many issues.
Right.
Is that true?
It's interesting. So I would say. I would say in general about Anglo Jewry that it is less extreme than American Jewry. So the right wing here tends to be less extreme than, or less hardline, or whatever you want to call it, than American Jewry. But also they're not as far to the left. Our version of J Street here is not as far to the left as J Street, and the ones even more to the left of J Street. We don't really, we don't have that problem to that extent here. So it works both ways. It's a bit more kind of a centrist community, but obviously we have plenty of disagreements. One of the reasons, I think one of the main reasons that the Limud tends to be more liberal, firstly, it started out as a, kind of anti-establishment, event, 20 years or whatever it was ago. It's obviously now metastasized into a much larger, event. As you see here, there's about 3,000 people here.
3,000 Jews, but most of them are from England.
Yes. Yeah. And most of them are also not Orthodox or... you may say there's a sizable number of what you might call secular Orthodox in Britain, which is a phenomenon almost unique to Britain, maybe South Africa, where you have, the shul I don't go to is an Orthodox one, right? But, I want nothing to do with, the non-Orthodox stuff. So there is Anglo Jewry is a kind of inheritor of German Jewry, and there's a famous machloket in German Jewry about the extent to which the Orthodox can work with the non-Orthodox. And this community has inherited that. And so there is a machloket in the Orthodox community about participation amongst Orthodox at Limud. And, I deeply respect that. I deeply respect both sides of that. And so there is a limit to the degree to which a lot of Orthodox, both rabbis and also lay people, will contribute here and will attend here.
Right. At the same time, though, it's very kosher, food-wise. Very kosher. In fact, Chalav Yisrael all over the place, which made me really happy. A lot of times when I'm going abroad, I don't find Chalav Yisrael, and therefore I start to lose weight, which is a blessing. at times. Very, very kosher. All the prayers were here, and there was a lot of people that were very respectful. I personally got to be involved in a lot of sessions that dealt with Hebron, that dealt with the alternatives to the two-state solution, narrative warfare, and I also got to sit on a lot of panels. I was on a panel today. Were you at my panel about should Jews? This is a great panel. Should Jews live in Hebron?
That was my panel. Yeah. I put that panel together. Yeah.
Tell me about that a little bit. And about both the issue of that panel and just in general formulating panels for Limud that get people inquisitive about nationalistic positions.
Right. So my involvement here, I'm one of an enormous number of volunteers either during the year or at the conference itself, which you would have seen. This is almost entirely volunteer-led. And this is like a week-long conference with 3,000 people. So it's a big enterprise with speakers from around the world like yourself and plenty of domestic ones. I'm very involved in the politics side of things. A, because I think there's a serious dearth here on that, and I'll come to that in just a moment. And also, I avoid the Torah stuff again because of the community issues, which as I said, I respect.
And just to clarify, you're saying that there are different tracks here at Limud. You involve yourself in the political track, stay out of the Torah track. There is a lot of Torah and textual stuff that's being learned here. That's not the kind of speakers that you invite.
That's exactly right. So I'm involved in the track that's for politics, history, and also philosophy, medical ethics, that sort of thing, archaeology. But I deal mostly with the politics, and in particular, my kind of brief, the one that I kind of, insisted that if I come on board, this is what I'm doing, and it was kind of accepted, then I would invite more, as you say, right-wing, hawkish, nationalistic, whatever you want to call them, those kind of speakers. There was a serious dearth of that here beforehand, and it kind of got pretty irritating. And I said, you know what, there are other views, and I think they need to be heard. I think people here need to hear them. And the truth is that the feedback has been tremendous over the past few years that I've done this. People have... There are always kind of, the silent, people who just kind of suffer through the things they don't agree with, but then you put someone in front of them they do agree with, and, people have come to my speakers and said, it's so refreshing to hear positive things about Israel, because, so much of the conversation about Israel on the left, both in Israel but also in the diaspora, is just, it's all doom and gloom, and everything's going the wrong way, and it's all terrible. So, you put reasonable people in front, and you said, actually, no, things are going really well in Israel, and it's really positive, and people like to hear that.
That's an interesting distinction that you make. Left, you would think that left is a certain amount of policies, a certain prescriptions, but not necessarily negativity. But what you're saying, and I have found that to be correct, is that generally the left today is just very negative in various ways about Israel. Israel's doing bad policy, Israel's a criminal, all kinds of shades of negativity. Then Reform and conservative rabbis come to me and they say, I don't know why, but we're losing our congregants to anti-Israelism. And it's like, well, that's because that's what you're basically teaching them. They're just taking it to the next step that you didn't want them to take the next step, but you taught them that it's so great to be critical of Israel, and now suddenly they hate Israel. Right. And it really, it's a weird thing that happens. And then you hear a right-wing person who thinks we should be strong about this, this, and this, but he's also in general, he or she is generally positive about the future of Israel and the direction that it's going.
Right. And a lot of that is also that those more on the left and also kind of, the non-Orthodox denominations. Again, there's overlap. Don't want to generalize, but, there's overlap. That they've also kind of got a deracinated Judaism.
A what?
A deracinated Judaism. It's a Judaism that has been emptied of content.
Deracinated?
Yeah.
Sorry. Like Jurassic Park? What, I don't know what you're talking about. Okay.
Oh, it was with a D. Anyway,
okay,
so
no problem.
Their Judaism has become liberalism. They got a problem where they perceive Israel to be going in an illiberal direction. I happen not to agree with that, but they think Israel's going in an illiberal direction. Their political values are liberalism, their religious values are liberalism. So they've got a conflict. But people on the right don't really have that conflict.
Right, that's a good point. I think there's one other reason. I think that there's a psychological reason that some people on the left today also want to distance themselves from Israel.
Right.
There's some kind of psychological need to say, okay, that's not my country, so that I can stay here in England or wherever and feel comfortable with my set of values. I don't need to be tugged away with that. Also, I'm disempowered there because there's not as many of me over there, so therefore it's not my country, and I'll find a way to intellectually, emotionally distance myself from it.
Yeah, it's complicated for Jews in the diaspora because Israel is such a part of their identity on the one hand, but also they can't vote, short of moving there, their ability to influence events there.
Also,
is
it's a different kind of Jew because you have a Jew here who operates in the diaspora as a Jew amongst the goyim. That's a different way of behavior, and by the way, I think completely a legitimate way that Jews have existed for the last 2,000 years, and continue to exist. But that's very different than being a sovereign people with their police powers and responsibilities to police criminality and other things, and to make a whole governmental system, and to make a lot of decisions and be judgmental. It's very hard for the person who Jewishly liberal, always calling for non-judgmentalism, so that he can calmly survive within the diaspora existence.
Yeah, I think that's right. But the non-judgmentalism thing is interesting, because that's kind of a theoretical proposition, but in practice, in my experience, that's not really the case. And a lot of liberals have a hard time listening to more conservative viewpoints. And there has been, some pushback here to some of the efforts that I'm making. But broadly speaking, it's been well received, or at least calmly received. But there is a bit of aggravation under the surface among some people. But I think that's good. That means that they're forced to reckon with opinions that they don't agree with.
And let me say something liberal here, which is that what we're talking about now are very broad strokes, very broad generalizations. The tensions between liberal and conservative Jews, or liberal and nationalistic Jews. It's not one-to-one. It's not exactly always striking as a set of values against one another. You find a lot of people here. Yesterday, one of the questions I got from a girl who made Aliyah, who voted for Naftali Bennett in Israel and Hillary Clinton in America. And so we're not trying to stereotype people overly, but stereotypes are helpful to understand things.
Right, but also the terminology itself has been complicated, because there are a lot of people, a lot of conservatives, who believe themselves today to be the true liberals.
Right.
And this is an argument that you've used, and some other people you've sat on panels with have used. Basically say, it's a liberal thing for Jews to be able to live wherever they want, for example, things like that. And it's the other side that's being illiberal by saying that, people's rights should be restricted in the name of something else.
Or what I use a lot is, in the name of your liberalism, you want to empower the most illiberal forces in this world, which is the jihad,
right,
and their friends and their cronies, or their thinly veiled front organizations who act liberal and use that language, but in a sense are nothing but the legitimate wing of the jihad, like UNESCO. Johnny, I have to admit that you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show. Johnny Newman at Limud here is my guest. We are in England. And I want to tell you something, Johnny. It might sound funny to you, but it keeps on dawning on me that I'm in England. I know it sounds a little funny, but the truth is, this is a very different place than America. It speaks English. There are crossover things. But at the same time, this is part of Europe. And even if it's not part of Europe in some way, it's very much its own thing. The Jews here have a completely different type of history. For example, this is a country that has had serious bouts of anti-Semitism, for example, evicting the Jews. Crusaders are big anti-Semites. There's all kinds of dark history here. There's also an amazing history of amazing Zionism, meaning to say the Zionism of the United States, that the American president, recognizes the state of Israel immediately. That's small compared to the Balfour Declaration and the efforts that happened in this place. This place was also, not so long ago, the pulsating heart, the empire of the world, the real West, the real intellectual West as well. Now I'm not exactly sure what its position is, and I don't understand exactly British Jewry. It's a lot closer physically to the land of Israel as well. And I wanted you just to comment a little bit about, what is a British Jew? What is Britain? Oh, also Britain, and my wife keeps pointing this out, it's a much older place. You could feel it. You could feel it. There's 1,500 years of history here. You could feel it in the houses and in the settled way that people live here. There's a certain British way. In fact, there was a session that I missed that I wanted to go to called What Are British Values? But there's a sense that there is such a thing, as opposed to America, which is a much more newer, more diverse type place. Tell me a little bit about being a British Jew.
You mentioned age. So I remember some years ago now, when I was at college, a friend of mine was doing a semester. An American friend of mine was doing a semester, and he's from California. And his mother came over to visit him, and so I showed them around my college, and the room that I was living in was older than the state of California.
Right.
So this is,
Where is that?
That was at Cambridge.
Right.
So there is a.
And when you go to Cambridge and Oxford, these places, you could feel it.
Oh yeah.
You could feel it. It's not. How should I say it? It's not touristic. It's real. You could feel the oldness in it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we don't see it very much exactly where we are in Limud. This is kind of a bubble. This conference, and it's made to be like that. But certainly, you step out and you see it everywhere.
Malk and I took the train down to Warwick Castle yesterday, and the Leamington spa. You could just feel it. immediately could just sense it. And it's also in the way of the people. You know, there's a well-established past here. How does that impact you as a Jew? I don't know exactly what I'm asking. There's just a mystery there that I don't know exactly how to bridge. I want to understand better how you folks relate to, because this is not America. That's my point.
Right. I think part of it is a mystery, in the same way that it's almost a mystery of how Israel works. You know, that you have, you know, there's so many divisions in Israeli society. You know, in any other country, there could have been, you know, any number of civil wars amongst these people. And yet, there's not even a trace of that. The country just gets on with it. And everyone, you know, solidarity in the country and so on. And there's something of a mystery there. And I think that's related because, you know, there was obviously a British mandate in Israel. A lot of the political institutions and a lot of the political culture come out of that in Israel. And part of it is that, you know, there's no constitution in Israel. You know, whatever some institutions would have you believe, there is technically no constitution in Israel, unlike in America, but like Britain, there's no constitution here either. Now, mm-hmm. with, you know, you see that with Brexit now, that everyone's not really sure, well, how do we do this, and whatever, we have no constitution to refer to. So this is not a country built on an idea in a way that America is. So America is much easier to understand. America is much easier to understand in that respect.
Right.
Britain is much more difficult. I think there is a degree of mystery here, and where exactly the Jewish people fit here. You know, we've been here for 300 years now. After being allowed back, after not being here for a few hundred years, and we were here before, it's difficult to know. We, mm-hmm. you know, the British Jews feel very British and they act very British, sometimes more British than the British. But what British values are, very difficult to say. People mm-hmm. will throw out, you know, platitudes, but, you know, they don't mean a great deal. There is a tradition of toleration here, but that's now become pluralism, which I think is a different thing. It's difficult. I think it's very difficult to pinpoint.
All right. There is one similarity between America and England right now. And that's another annoying thing here, which is like England, Britain, and UK. Just to understand the difference between those three things exactly, you know, I'm still not tight on it exactly. And I ask people, I have asked already a few people, I've asked maybe 10 people, I said, are you British? They're like, no, I'm English. I ask people, are you English? No, I'm British. I'm like, I'm not exactly tight on that. But a similarity is that something just happened here in England, which is very similar to what has happened in America, and that is that the conservative base, the people, the hoi polloi, the rednecks, the people of the land, and I specifically do not mean to denigrate those people, have made a political move that has been shocking, a great reversal, and in some ways also against what many majority of the Jews would have liked. In America, the election of Trump, here the voting for Brexit, which means that England is going to pull out of the European Union. What's the similarity there?
Look, I think the Jews went the way of a segment of the segment of the population in both countries because it is very similar to that segment of the population. So that was the case with the urban population, the more secular population, the cosmopolitan population in both countries. Both went, you know, anti-Brexit in this country. They wanted to stay within the European Union, and anti-Trump in America. And because the Jews are very similar to those other segments of society, I don't think there's anything kind of particularly Jewish, much as they might express it in some way. I don't think there's anything particularly Jewish. I think the Jews follow the trends in the countries that they're in, depending on their professions.
Well, they were on the wrong side of both these issues. Am I right that the Jews here in England were against Brexit, were for staying in the European Union?
They were on the losing side.
Well, right.
So it's here on the wrong side. Yeah, they were on the losing side. Yeah.
That's what I meant by the wrong side. Sorry, you're right. Your correction is accepted. That's right. That's funny. It showed a little bias there. But they were on the losing side, right? Or I meant to say by the wrong side, what I meant to say is, and your correction is right, but they weren't sensitive to where the people were.
I think so. Again, I think that's a function of the almost bubbles in which they live. You know, most Jews in this country live in London. And London was an island of Remain in a country, in England's
We would call
England's
that blue.
Let's say it's blue, and the rest of England is red.
Right.
Right? So it's not a function of them being Jewish per se, it's a function of them being in London, being lawyers and right. professionals and traveling a lot and being, you know, middle class and upper middle class and so on, with obviously exceptions. In both communities, by the way, the more religious I think, went the other way. Certainly, right, in Trump's case, and I think in Brexit as well.
Right. In my good friends in Brooklyn always tell me that, you know, the Orthodox communities, except for Satmar, were all red in within Brooklyn, and Brooklyn went totally blue, but the Orthodox Jews were totally red.
Right.
That's a fascinating thing. All right, we're at Limud. There's 3,000 people here. There's a lot of Jewish knowledge being learned. There's a lot of transmission of information. Tell me, we'll wrap up with this. What's the future of this organization? What's the future of your involvement? What's the future of people like me speaking here?
Future of the organization, I think, you know, it's expanding all over the world. There's Limud, former Soviet Union. There's Limud in Israel. There's Limud in the States. There's Limud everywhere. I think they're pretty different.
Canada, all
over the world. Every continent, all over the world. Each will have their own character. I think it's an extraordinary thing for people here who don't, you know, these aren't for the most part people who spend their days in a Beit Midrash or their evenings in a Beit Midrash. So for them to take annual leave here, take time off work to come because they want to learn about, you know, Torah, they want to learn about the Jewish community, Judaism, to take a week out to do that is an extraordinary thing. You know, I'm staying involved for the time being. I'm going to continue to bring people like you and people with those views. I think they need to be heard. So this is a safe space for you now.
I don't know about safe space, and I'm not sure I'm looking for necessarily safe spaces, but I'll tell you what, though. I am looking for my brothers and sisters, and I certainly have found them here at Limud. I have found that it's an incredible opportunity to speak to people that it's not always easy to get to have that. And I've had a few statements that I've made that the room has gone completely silent. They've just looked at me, not even negatively, not even positively, just kind of a stunned type of look. Like when I was ripping the Kotel a little bit. I was saying, you know, the Western Wall is not so important. You know, we're Temple Mount people. The Western Wall, you know, until 1655, people prayed at the Southern Wall. It's not so important. If you told me that my minion is at the Southern Wall, I'd go there. And just people looked at me as though I had... They were just stunned. They had never heard that. But that experience of talking with fellow Jews, of giving them, you know, new visions, in my opinion, also from the cutting edge of Israel, has been very rewarding to me. And it's also a kind of kirev. It's an intellectual kirev. Kirev to Israel, a kirev to our way of looking at things, advocacy certainly, and you have to love your Jewish brothers and sisters, and this is the opportunity. Also here on Hanukkah, and also with the advent of some liquor that has been very helpful here. There is a flow of liquor. There has been excellent beers, and I had some tequila shots with you. I hope to have again tequila shots with you over this incredible opportunity to speak to brothers and sisters. Johnny, thanks so much.
I love that, Yisrael. Thanks so much for having me. Thank you.
During the darkest time of the year, we light the Hanukkah candles to remember that the truth and values we brought to the world at Mount Sinai will endure forever, and that every person who loves Israel and stands with Israel is a modern-day Maccabee. And just as God performed magnificent miracles before the eyes of the world through the Maccabees in those days, God is performing even greater miracles through the Maccabees at this time. Because here in the land of Israel, we never forget that just one candle can illuminate the entire world.
Happy Hanukkah from the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.
This is Eve Harrow, host of Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. My maternal grandparents, Grandpa Morris and Grandma Lily, came to the United States from Russia over 100 years ago. They belonged to the Mizrahi movement, way before there was even a state of Israel. The Land of Israel Network is powered by the Mizrahi World Movement.
All right, friends, I'm here at the Limud Conference in Birmingham, England. Birmingham, if you would read it. It's a massive conference. 3,000 Jews are here doing all kinds of Jewish activities. As you can hear in the background, there's some students of film and music doing their stuff. There's many variances of Jewish culture that are happening here. Of course, the Jewish state also figures prominently. And one of the sessions that I had the privilege of visiting today was with Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, who's the head of the foreign and social media desk at the IDF spokesman's office. And he says on his Twitter page, "I speak and tweet for those that serve." And he's got 43,000 followers on Twitter. He's very, very powerful on Twitter. And that's really one of the efforts today that Israel must have, is on the front of legitimacy, on the front of narrative, on the front of Israel's reputation, which is really also the battle that you're fighting. The IDF is, and the class that you gave today, session that you gave today was about Israel's defensive postures. But one of the things you didn't talk about is what you really do yourself, which is in the field of what I call the narrative war.
Thanks, Yishai. That is actually what I'm going to be talking about tomorrow in tomorrow's session. So I would say absolutely the world of media affairs, public opinion, has grown both in importance and magnitude over the last years, and it's empowered. You know, the whole world has changed due to social media. And so definitely the IDF is a core player on that playing field, and we have a substantial presence. I personally have a presence. But definitely as an organization, we have a prominence and many, many levels of information we are constantly conveying to the global audience who are interested in knowing what's going on, what's the true story, what is the real story, and how the IDF is relating to that.
To back up a little bit, I didn't say that you're the only man, person in this whole conference wearing a uniform, and not a chef's uniform or another uniform, but a service uniform of the IDF. You are in uniform right now, and you wear two, what we call in Israel, falafels, or what do they call them in English? Two stars of a lieutenant colonel, and you are a decorated soldier. You are a career soldier. That's what you do. You are an active, how do we call it? Active soldier in the IDF.
That's right, an active serviceman. And I am, to the best of my knowledge, this is the first time a serving soldier has actually appeared in Limud. At this conference, and I think it's increasingly important to get our message across and share with people that sometimes are on the fronts in the battlefield at university or at college, or sometimes just at work, and the people raise questions that people don't necessarily know how to answer. And definitely my job here has been to share the challenges that the IDF, the Israel, face in the modern battlefield, the types of enemies that we have, the way terrorism has evolved into this hybrid form of warfare that challenges modern militaries extensively in the ways that they conduct themselves. You know, the way terrorist organizations conduct themselves from the heart of civilian population means that modern militaries are extremely challenged in a way that might, you know, the world perhaps cannot even understand today. And Israel, the IDF, is at the forefront of that. And I can say for certain that the world is coming constantly to learn from us.
Let me kind of get people into the muck of what you're talking about. What you're talking about is that if Hamas, for example, might shoot a rocket at Israel, if Israel would do the normal military thing, which is to shoot a rocket back at where that rocket emanated from through a process called triangulation, and shoot right back to where it fired from, they very well may kill 100 kids in a school building. And that would be not only would be something we don't want to do by killing children, but also would be exactly what Hamas would want us to do. They want to see they want to create an image of Israel as a child murderer, and that would fit their image, and that's why they put their cameras ready to capture that kind of image, that kind of moment.
Absolutely. From their perspective, it's a win-win situation. If we respond, they potentially win. If we don't respond, they potentially win, because it would cause death and destruction on the Israeli side. So our job is actually a job of predetermining and having the enough intelligence beforehand to know where the rockets potentially could be shot from, or the tunnels where they come out from, and the extent of the use of the civilian arena, the urban areas, by our enemies is unbelievable. It is, you know, the way they position, they have no regard for human life. They position their munitions in schools, beneath mosques, in residential areas, jeopardizing the civilians in those areas and effectively making them legitimate targets. Now, that puts a huge weight on our shoulders, because it means we have to constantly deliberate and weigh up the proportionality of the strike, because you can't expect us not to fight against people who are jeopardizing and potentially risking our civilians just because they're hiding behind theirs. So there is definitely a thought process and a decision-making process that binds into that in order to think and act, in order to defend our soldiers and effectively limit the civilian casualty on the other side, and at the same time negate the threat that the terrorists have.
You have, in your talk earlier and also already on this program, you have used terms that are unambivalent, clear. And say, you want to kill the bad guys. You said that in your speech. You know, we are there to defend Israel. You're not using terminology that sometimes Israel has used in the past, which has sounded wishy-washy. Like there is a war out there, a war of terrorism that tries to undermine the legitimacy and the strength of Israel and tries to kill Israelis. Sometimes I find that the Israeli Hasbara industry doesn't want to say it straight out, what we have to do in order to defend ourselves. I found it refreshing that you used terms that were unambiguous and clear about what the role of the IDF is as this fighting machine to defend Israel.
Thank you, Yishai. But, you know, that is the military, and I proudly wear this uniform, and I have the privilege of being able to speak clearly in the level of, you know, the military, how we assess the situation and how we translate the reality into actionable items. I'm, you know, the military in itself is that type of body, and I've been in this position now for 4 years, and that's the way I believe that this needs to be conveyed, and the messages need to be clear enough, but also a level of acceptance needs to be. So they need to be not necessarily shoved down the listener or viewers or readers' opinion, but they need to be able to listen what I say. Trust me that what I'm saying is truthful and enough examples, and then accept and even question it sometimes. We have no problem with people questioning, but definitely the reality and the credibility that the IDF spokesperson's unit gets today from international media, from our followers on social media, definitely is a high level of credibility. People actually wait to hear what we say before they make their own decision.
And you have deployed now really a lot of video teams to capture stuff in the front in all kinds of situations, some harrowing situations. You have deployed much more than before video. There's a lot of cutesy stuff, like, you know, soldiers lighting the Hanukkah candles and stuff like that, but there's also like real operational stuff that you show in order to really stem some of the lies against how the IDF operates.
Absolutely. People want to be shown, they don't want to be told. And our job is to translate that into action. You know, what they say is that 90% of what people accept is via visuals. So if you show them, then they're more susceptible to accepting. And people compute visuals something like 66,000 times quicker than they do than reading an article. So you need to be extremely visual. You need to be able to convey that message quick. You need to be able to be in sync with everything that is the attention grabbers in their pocket, the cell phone.
All right, so you gave a talk. We're speaking with Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner from the IDF spokesman's office. Follow him on Twitter, along with 44,000 other people. Peter, you gave a talk which I thought also was kind of revealing about the strategic situation that Israel is facing right now on its borders. And basically one could have come out with not the happiest of pictures. It is quite tense on many of the borders of Israel and volatile. You even used three terms which were synonyms of different kinds, meaning to say that what did you say? Volatility,
I said,
unpredictability, and there was another one. I don't remember. It was on the board. But the point was, the situation was always given to change. You said something also about Hamas. You said that Hamas every day is developing new rockets, and every day they fire them into the ocean.
Yeah.
In order to test them. Tell me about that.
So definitely everywhere we look, Israel is currently in the eye of the storm. So you see craziness going up on the border with Syria. You see Hezbollah on the border with Lebanon building a huge weapons capability beyond most European countries today. And you see Hamas constantly building its force in order to have some sort of tactical advantage in potential future confrontation that we may have. And absolutely, they are testing their materials. They are building rockets and launching them into sea to try and see their durability. How far can they go? Will they be sustainable? Will they be able? How precise are they? So definitely, Hamas in Gaza are constantly more concerned with building their military capabilities than actually looking out for the people of Gaza themselves, which are ultimately paying the most substantial price for their leadership. Our concern, of course, is that they will try and create some sort of tactical surprise that will catch us off guard. So it could be tunnels, it could be drone warfare, it could be underwater capabilities that they've proven that they have in the past, but they will obviously be trying to develop those further, and that for us is a huge concern. You know, we have to be able to take away those potential threats in a real-time basis and negate their capabilities and their attempt to try and have an image or vision of success against Israel, against the IDF. You know, we have to have contingency plans, we have to have operational plans, and we have to have defensive mechanisms like the Iron Dome or physical barriers along the border that could prevent easy infiltration against Israel.
And of course, there's the broader enemies like Iran, who are not exactly on our borders, but are sending their, you know, they have their proxy Hezbollah, and other things that I'm sure you can't even talk to us about the challenges that the IDF has with global terrorism, and a region that is really very jihadist right now. The jihadist milieu is the leading milieu in the Middle East.
So absolutely, the reality that we see is an attempt by Iran to create this Shiite crescent from Iran via Iraq through Syria and Lebanon towards the Mediterranean. And that is a huge destabilizer of the region if they are successful in that. Iran has, in essence, upheld its part of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Israeli view on that, of course, that it isn't comprehensive enough. It doesn't deal with Iran as the largest global generator of terrorism. It doesn't deal with Iran's ballistic missile program that just earlier this year tested a missile and had written on it in Hebrew that Israel needs to be wiped off of the face of the earth. They did it so well that they didn't make any spelling mistakes in Hebrew. So they are sending us a clear message. And I think the last component of concern that we have with Iran is what happens down the line when we have a more self-confident, more powerful Iran in the region, when the interim period of the agreement comes to an end. Will they continue to seek their nuclear capabilities or not, and how they will implement those? And of course, that from a global perspective, that needs to be of concern. When you see what the countries across the world engaging Iran with commerce and channeling perhaps more money towards Iran, that for us is a concern when they are involved in so much badness across the world.
Peter, you talk about the IDF in terms of its defensive capacities and Israel's threats. And we talked also about the narrative war. We talked about the physical war. There's been also a lot of change in the IDF itself. I remember when I was a lone soldier 20 years ago, there was almost no consciousness of lone soldiers. We were literally at the time lone soldiers. Today, there's such a consciousness about soldiers. There's a great love for soldiers. FIDF is raising hundreds of millions of dollars. People have pictures of soldiers. People want to send soldiers pizzas all the time and socks or whatever it is. There's like a different relationship that the Jewish world and lovers of Israel in general have with the IDF that wasn't there beforehand, certainly not when I was I'm still a soldier, reserve soldier, but when I was a regular conscript. Tell me a little bit about the IDF as an organization and how the Jewish world and lovers of Israel see it.
So the IDF, of course, is a military of the people, and it is a reflection of Israeli society. And, you know, there are currently about 3,500 lone soldiers serving, and that is a constant number, basically, more or less. But that's the amount of people we have serving that are lone soldiers every year. And I would say generally, the IDF is respected, honored, and it is just because of those talented young men and women that join our ranks and fill our units. The reality of a conscript army is a challenging reality because it is constantly under question by society. Do we still need this type of model? Do we require a conscript military? And what it means with relation to society. So we have to constantly be with our fingers on our pulse to make sure we are doing the right thing for the right people And making sure that people have, you know, it can be basic things like food and clothing and air conditioning when you're serving in the heat of the desert in 42 degrees and there's, you know, no shade around. So definitely there's a challenge there. And Israel and the IDF as a whole comes under a lot of scrutiny internally in Israeli society. But we live up to that. And we are very, very conscious of how society sees us. We don't want them to see us as an overbloated organization, so there is cutbacks. We don't want them to see us as an organization that does not respect the other, you know, traits of life, whether it's education, social welfare, or even environment. So it's definitely an army of the state for the state.
And finally, Limud itself. This is your first time at Limud, Limud UK. You are UK born. You left the UK when you were 12. But you're back here now at Limud, speaking to a large audience of people, Jews, a lot of them also liberal Jews, different folks who aren't, who, you know, want to be plugged into the State of Israel. State of Israel is important to them. They don't necessarily agree with some of the policies of the State of Israel. But you're out here representing, you're out here connecting to other Jews. Tell me about your experience here at Limud so far.
So first of all, it's a great opportunity to be here. I have I'm overwhelmed by the energy, the positiveness, you know, the spirit of volunteering to keep this thing going, and it's going strong. 3,000 Jews in one place is a challenge anywhere in the world, and I think here what I've seen is a huge diversity, diversity that reflects Judaism across the world and also in Israeli society. I liked the hard questions because I think these are the people that are struggling with the hard questions, whether they're at work or at university, and definitely, you know, Israel is important to them, and therefore they will ask me and grill me on the hard questions. I've been grilled here like I've been grilled on the BBC, and I welcome that. And I think this type of opportunity for me to be here on behalf of the IDF and representing the IDF and the positions and the reality as we reflect, and the threats and the challenges that we face, I think it gives that opportunity for the people that want to identify with Israel, sometimes find some of the actions hard to identify with because of lack of information or because of a slanted view from the media or a reality that does not necessarily, that it's very hard to identify with because they haven't got all of the facts. So it definitely gives them a chance to face those questions, take them up, and raise them, and that's what I found. I've been welcomed here very warmly. I can't say that, you know, even people that are critical of us are respectful and open, not too open, you know, because, you know, if you have a too open mind, your brain might fall out. So you don't want that. You want people that can listen, can be critical thinkers, I was urging them, you know, you have to give us some credit. We're not just doing things just because this is what we like to do. We do it because we have no other choice. We operate under crazy circumstances, and that's the reality of modern day warfare. And I would say and challenge anybody, we do it probably better than anyone else in the world.
Peter Lerner, you're certainly doing it amazingly for Israel. You're here at Limud in uniform, the uniform of the IDF and representing the State of Israel and its defensive capacities, its fighting capacities, which really is one of the hearts of Zionism. The return to our language, certainly, the return to our land, the return to our culture, but also the return to the Jew who can fight back against what we couldn't fight back during the Second World War, the Holocaust. Now we are able to do it, and you're representing us here. Adeline, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
The best place to stay in Jerusalem is at Windows of Jerusalem Vacation Apartments. Check out their website, www.windowsofjerusalem.com. They've got beautiful 1, 2, 3, 4 bedroom apartments in the best location in the city center with the most beautiful, breathtaking views. And I mean breathtaking. I've stayed there a number of times myself. And I'm telling you, there are few places anywhere in the city where you can take it all in to this degree. The view, the location, the great apartments, plus the wonderful staff will truly make you feel at home in Jerusalem. Book your stay now at windowsofjerusalem.com.
Hey folks, this is Jeremy Gimpel. I want you to know, if you're a non-Jew from a Christian background or just a full-fledged Christian and you want to come to Israel, the best program tour experience that you could possibly have is to go with Hayovel. Now, it's weird. I'm an Orthodox Jewish rabbi, and I'm telling Christians to go to this Christian ministry in the middle of Samaria. Let me tell you, there is no better experience for someone outside of the land, outside of the Jewish fold, to come into the land and work alongside the Jewish farmers of Samaria, to learn about the culture, to meet the people. It's an experience like no other, and I think it's also probably the cheapest way to travel to Israel. So go to Hayovel.com.
Hanukkah light burns so bright. Hanukkah, Hanukkah, come light the menorah. Open my lockers in the air sometimes.
Light one candle for the Maccabee children.
Hi, everybody. Eve Harrow, host of Rejuvenation. On behalf of myself and all of the hosts and wonderful staff behind the Land of Israel Network, I want to wish all of you a happy Hanukkah, a joyous festival of lights. And may we here at the Land of Israel Network continue to shine the light of Israel on the world. Thanks so much, everybody, for listening and supporting us.